This is so great. Ever since we switched to a 3-day work week, I have so much time to sit by this beautiful pond.
I can't even remember what it was like in the bad old days.
Yeah, still imagine if I was at work today. I wonder what kind of intro I'd be recording for the show. I mean, I wonder, you know, what kind of special effects I'd need or...
Yeah, I think the point is not to think about things like that.
True. I know. That's true. But this morning I was looking online. Did you see the whole thing about Amazon misusing the words of George Orwell? I wonder if we'd be talking about that if we were working.
You're scaring the fish.
You know that's a misconception, right? Before we cut back our work week, we were going to do this whole show about fish and what they know and don't know. Did you know that sharks have this keen sense of electricity? Do we have connectivity here? Let me pull up a study from Life Science.
Give me that iPad, and I'll show you a study that proves that past a certain point, working extra hours actually makes people less creative and effective.
But, Greg, I don't feel good. You know, I'm used to judging my worth by my productivity. I'm not happy now. You know, maybe we made a mistake in changing the structure of work life without first, you know, laying the groundwork with a metamorphosis of human consciousness. That's it. We need to go back to work full-time, maybe 70 hours a week, shifting the entire perspective of humankind to a new paradigm based on symbiosis and regeneration, as opposed to this zero-sum competition-based... Naps. We have years of work to do before civilization is ready for naps. We need to build an app for naps. Come on, let's go back up and head out to work. Greg, dang it. Today, Maria Konnikova on the 3-day work week, Amanda Hess on whether exaggerated man-hating is a good joke, and Juliet Macer on auto racing's latest stains. And now, in order to cut back his work week, he'd have to take a sabbatical to get a life. Colin McEnroe.
That's the paradox that I'm caught in, right? In order to work less, I'd have to have a life, and I don't have time right now to develop a life. So if I cut back to a 3-day work week, I would be in a state of paralysis because I don't have a life to go to. All right. That's one of the many topics we're going to be talking about today. You know, I'm thinking about today's show, which we put together pretty fast and with as a result of no planning whatsoever. We have three of the absolute hottest and most happening women journalists and writers in America. So that's a good argument for something anyway. I don't think it's an argument for a 3-day work week, but it's an argument for something. So we are going to start with Maria Konnikova. She's a contributing writer to The New Yorker online, where she writes a weekly column with a focus on psychology and science. She's the author of Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes, her second book, a nonfiction book on the psychology of the con, wherein presumably she will answer the question whether or not W.C. Fields or George Orwell or whoever said it was right when they said you can't cheat an honest man. That's due out next winter. We want to do a whole show about that with her. You can also hear her regularly on one of my favorite podcasts, The Gist with Mike Pesca, where she has a regular feature called Does This Have the Ring of Veracity? Actually, that's not what it's called, but we can't say what it's called because of what it's called. So, Maria Konnikova, we're very excited to have you on our show today.
I'm very excited to be here, Colin.
And please don't say the real title of your segment with Mike Pesca.
I won't, don't worry.
But I think Does This Have the Ring of Veracity is a nice substitute anyway.
It is. Well done. I was wondering how you were going to do that. Yeah. So I was very impressed.
And in terms of your book on the psychology of the con, does it in fact have a title yet?
It does. It's called The Confidence Game.
The Confidence Game. Mm-hmm. You have to the House of Games with Joe Mantegna, the David Mamet movie. Best movie about cons I've ever seen. Much better than The Sting.
Yeah, well, Mamet is obsessed with cons. If you think about the movies he's done, so many of them return to those themes. And that's, I think, one of the reasons he loves to work with Ricky Jay.
No, absolutely. All right. Well, we can't wait for that, but that's not what we're here to talk about. We're going to start with this notion of the 3-day work week. So we're sort of discovering, as you point out, John Maynard Keynes brought all this up in 1930, but now it's really coming true that to a certain degree anyway, a lot of automation can replace some of the work that we do, and even the people who had to supervise the robots in the past can now be replaced by robots that supervise other robots and then a robot that will supervise that robot. And so there are some real questions, not only about whether our productivity is needed, but also about whether, even if our productivity was needed, this is the best way to make use of it. There are so many factors, so many variables about this. But I'll sort of let you start the story wherever you want. I mean, there are a couple of proposals floating out there, including one from a Mexican telecom magnate, about how to make better use of people's work time. So what did you make of all this?
Well, what originally prompted the story was this proposal by Carlos Slim for a 3-day work week. And when I thought about it, I thought, hey, you know, it's really interesting that someone who has made his fortune by really, you know, working people incredibly hard, has come to this realization. And there's a very deep truth that Keynes was trying to get at, but he didn't understand something about the nature of Americans and the nature of, well, his fellow British compatriots, when he thought with automation and with all of these great advances, we're not going to be working as much. Instead, what has happened is we have all this technology, we could be working less, but instead the trend has reversed and we're now working more. And often during your free time on the weekends and the evenings when you're not in the office, that same technology that could have been making your life easier is now intruding into your leisure time. And so instead of having leisure time, you're checking your email, you're responding to your boss. And you feel really guilty if you have a weekend off of email. And it's this really interesting tension between, on the one hand, well, we don't have to work, and on the other hand, we keep working and we keep having this expectation that comes from above and that comes from the expectations of the workplace.
And so, I mean, you can apply logic to this, but nobody really does start there. In fact, as later when we're talking about wines and tasting wines, this is going to come up again. I mean, you can't think clearly and logically about this without having to part first the jungle of other kinds of overlays of expectations and attitudes. So there's clearly an attitude in the so-called knowledge-based work sector that if you're an effective worker, you're working a lot. Go ahead.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. Somewhere along the line, good work has been replaced with long work, and those things have become synonymous, which in fact they aren't. And the interesting thing is, if you look at the data and if you look at the research that we're getting from psychology and from organizational psychology, that's psychologists who actually study businesses and business behavior, you see that there's a point after which we become much less productive. And the workers who are the best, who are more productive, more creative, more innovative, basically more of an asset to the workforce, aren't the workers who work the most. They're the people who can take time off and the people who can control their schedules, can be more flexible about when they do work and when they don't work. Yet somehow no one looks at this data and says, okay, we should actually implement this in our workforce because it's so deeply ingrained in us that that's not the case.
You know, and this has all kinds of ramifications and implications. I mean, for example, this notion of a 4-day work week or even a 3-day work week, which is, I think, the title of your piece, has implications even environmentally. I mean, if we're not driving back and forth to work 5 days a week, presumably we're emitting fewer greenhouse gases. And it's odd when you start thinking about that because there are all these other ways in which the reshaping of the workday kind of militates against environmentalism. For example, in Mexico, they went to speaking of Carlos Slim, they went to a more standard work day, got rid of the siesta, which sort of put people off the work premises from the middle of the day, and they go back to work in the cooler evening hours. Now they've got to ratchet up the air conditioning so that they can keep people at work for this kind of standard 8-hour office day. But the 3-day work week is really interesting just at that level of carbon emissions, right? I mean, let's get people off, to have them work a longer day, 3 days a week, and then get them off the roads.
Absolutely. And the same thing has happened in Spain. Spain has also upped its hours because it's also gotten rid of its siestas. And you see the ramifications in very deep ways. And I think it's kind of this preeminence of the United States and of that kind of Protestant work ethic has really started to spread globally, and people are ignoring local practices that were there for a reason and that were working. So the siesta wasn't just people being lazy. It was over a long period of time people realizing, hey, if it's really hot outside, I'm not going to be that productive. It's really good to have that built into the workday. But now we're forgetting everything we've known in the past. And if you even think about the United States, before electricity, people's work days were really dictated by the amount of sunlight. So yes, you would work more in the summers, but you'd also work far, far less in the winters. And now we can work always, and so we've decided, well, that's the best way to be. And we don't realize that, hey, maybe you don't want a surgeon who's been working for 48 hours. Maybe you don't want a pilot who has been flying 3 times in a row and is starting to nod off. In fact, maybe you don't want a lawyer looking at your documents who's been doing this now for, you know, 12 hours and his eyes are just glazing over. None of that sounds like a good idea. And yet.
Yeah. Well, and so there are some counter currents. I mean, we mentioned Carlos Slim, who must know something. He's usually like the second richest man in the world or the first or something like that. Economists have proposed this. And, you know, one of the places that this obtains as a value, this kind of hyper work state, is in investment banking, where, you know, if you want to be Leo DiCaprio and the Wolf of Wall Street, you have to go have martinis with Matthew McConaughey. But then you have to work these sort of incredible hours, except that now Goldman Sachs and some other companies are saying, no, you know what? Maybe that's not so great. Maybe you shouldn't even be allowed to do any work on Saturdays.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting shift that we're seeing. Goldman's initiative of work-free Saturdays, I thought, was fascinating because, well, first you think about, hey, why do we need even a work-free Saturdays and Saturday weekend? But in areas like investment banking, that's not the case, and you're really expected to be available and working 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And what Goldman has said is, no, actually, after a certain time Friday evening and until 9 a.m. on Sunday morning, no email. You cannot email your subordinates unless there's an emergency. And we now have some preliminary data. They made this proposal about a year ago. I don't remember the exact date, that it's working out pretty well and that this shift actually is happening. And I think the key thing is it's being instigated from the top. And so if your bosses truly accept that and truly follow it, well, then it's much easier for the workers to follow that sort of ethic as well. If it's just the workers who say, hey, we want to work less, it's never going to happen.
So there's some areas where it's just going to be very difficult to transform the culture. Medicine is probably the worst one, particularly that notion of residence and, you know, what people have to do almost at the level of machismo or something to earn their stripes. You know, and the notion that maybe somebody shouldn't work 80 hours straight is really regarded as some kind of, I don't even know what, it's like a transgressive statement. What do you mean we can't force these young doctors to work 80 hours straight, even though no patient wants to be seen by a doctor in hour 79, right?
Absolutely. And it's crazy. They've tried to reform this for the last 20 years, and it's so controversial. And even when they finally passed a limit on the hours, people are finding loopholes so that the residents can continue to work longer. And to me, it's just insane. Wouldn't everyone want this? No, they don't.
So the question will be, what president in a, you know, still a Protestant work ethic dominated society is going to be able to go on national television and say, look, everybody needs to work less. We want you to be happy and creative and fulfilled. He'll be burned in effigy, probably, or she'll be burned in effigy.
I look forward to that presidential speech.
That will be a wonderful speech. It'll be sort of the coda to the Jimmy Carter Malaise speech. We're going to lift your malaise and make you happy, but you have to work less. Speaking about being made happy, one of the other fascinating Maria Konnikova articles, a whole category of knowledge we now call Konnikovana, is an article about, and these all three things we're going to talk about kind of interrelated in an interesting way. So we assume, well, actually, no, let me give you sort of a real life example. So I'm about to take a little trip and I need someplace to stay. And so I jump on Travelocity and I jump on Airbnb and VRBO and I'm trying to figure out, do I want a hotel? Do I want to rent somebody's apartment? If so, what kind of apartment? There's so many different things that I can look at. I'm looking at all kinds of choices. I'm completely miserable right now. This is I have so many things to choose from. I can absolutely wind up with something wonderful. I suppose I can also accidentally wind up with something that will make me unhappy. But mainly I'm unhappy right now because it's so hard to make this decision. The state I'm in, Maria Konnikova, is not surprising to you, correct?
That is correct. You're in a state called an approach conflict, which means you have all of these options and they all sound kind of good to you. But instead of making that choice easier because, hey, you can't really go wrong, it really ratchets up your anxiety. And so you think, oh, my God, what happens if I don't do this? What happens if I don't do that? And instead of being happy, you become really stressed out by just the overwhelming abundance of options. And I keep saying overwhelming abundance, but this is true even if you just had to choose between two really good things. Like if there are two types of chocolate, both chocolate that you really, really love, and you're trying to choose one or the other, that's going to have that same sort of anxiety-provoking effect.
And I think this has long-term implications because, in fact, due to digital culture and the ability to kind of comparison shop and shop across multiple platforms, or choose, not just shop, but choose all kinds of things across multiple platforms, we're going to do more choosing. You know, we don't, you know, back to your idea about working during only the hours when there's sunlight 150 years ago, you know, we don't live in one little town where there's only one doctor and there's only one this and only one that, and the Wells Fargo wagon comes through once in a while. But, I mean, really, you don't have that many choices. You have infinite numbers of choices, and that's only going to expand. So in a way, we, judging from some of the behavioral experiments that you looked at, we don't really have the right equipment to get through this incredible thicket of choices.
No, we don't. I think it's going to provoke more kind of existential crises and people going to psychiatrists and psychologists and saying, you know, I don't know what's wrong with me. Look at all these things I have, and I'm so miserable. The psychologist will say, well, of course, that makes total sense. But you're absolutely right when you say that we're not really equipped to deal with it, because we don't even really understand that it's a problem. We think lots of choice good. We think looking at your Twitter feed and seeing a million different things that you could potentially click on, good. We don't think overload, my system is going into red mode. And that's what we should be thinking. And there are tools out there for that, but we don't know to look for them. You don't know, for instance, that you should probably limit your choices ahead of time so that you don't get into that situation. Who wants to do that? You don't want to limit your choices. You want everything out there.
Some marketers are going to figure this out. I mean, I've seen it happen in the past. For a long time, Stu Leonard's supermarkets, when they were located only, there's a couple of them down in Fairfield County, they would be studied by other companies. And one thing that they did was, instead of offering you six different brands of toilet paper, they offered you maybe the house brand toilet paper and one other kind that they'd bought, you know, at the absolute, the most favorable bulk rate so that they could discount it. And I think people do like that. I mean, who wants to be sitting there holding up one roll of toilet paper after, or one package of toilet paper after another, trying to figure out what the best deal is balanced against whatever softness or squeezability we're looking for?
That's absolutely right, and that's actually incredibly smart. I think I was reading recently that I think it was Procter & Gamble, but it might have been another one of the really big firms, has done the exact same thing and decided to, just a few weeks ago, cut dramatically the number of brands that they're offering and the number of options. And I think that's actually a very smart idea. Marketers have definitely figured out that more isn't more. Now it's up to humans to discover that for us personally, more isn't more. Because for them, they can look and say, oh, look, bottom line is when we limit the options, we make more revenue. So for them, it's something that they can easily see. But for us, it's so difficult to convince someone that limiting their choice is a good thing, because we're all about having all the possible choices. And so if someone tells me, okay, well, I'm going to limit the choices, you're going to say, no, that's paternalistic. I don't want you to limit my choices. I want to be able to choose everything that I want from all of the available options. We don't have that same economic calculus that a company has, and that's really hard.
I hate even to think how this will play out on Match.com and places like that, but it probably will anyway. But one of the things to remember anyway is sometimes with too many choices, people do nothing, right? One of the models that you cite, I don't know if I'm saying it right, Buridan's ass.
Yep.
I hate talking about anybody's ass, but this is an apocryphal donkey, right?
Yes, and he has two lovely haystacks that would make wonderful food, and he's standing between them, and they're equidistant, and he doesn't know which one to choose, and so he starves to death. And he starves with all this food around him just because he can't decide which haystack to go to. And I think that's a very good metaphor for how we sometimes feel. And we end up either in a suboptimal decision or not even making a choice at all. We say, oh, you know what, forget it. Let's just not go out for dinner tonight. Let's just order in from the same old restaurant, or let's just cook dinner and not worry about it, because you don't want to deal with all of this anxiety. You're not starving. You end up with dinner, but then again, you're not a donkey.
Right, and you had time to cook dinner because you were only working a 3-day work week, so you had
that
day off. You could shop for ingredients at a farmer's market and be really bewildered by all the third choices they have there. Well, if you are making dinner and you're inviting Maria Konnikova over, do not uncork and serve the 2012 Crow's Hermitage from Alain Greault, because she doesn't like it. She knows she doesn't like it, and she's pretty sure that she wouldn't like it even if you decanted it into some other bottle with a much more cheerful-looking label, but she's no longer that sure that she would know not to like it. Explain why that is, that this notion that when we taste something, it's so difficult to do it in a state of pure isolation and lack of influence from outside sources.
Yeah, the idea, which I think is a fascinating one and goes really far beyond wine, is that everything is influenced by our expectations. So what you expect to experience at any given point will influence what you actually experience. So if I, for instance, let's talk about something other than wine. If I pour myself a glass of water and it's from a brand I know, for instance, I like San Pellegrino, so I'm going to put a San Pellegrino into my water glass, I'm already anticipating how that's going to taste, and to me, it's going to taste more like that. If someone had, without my knowledge, put, for instance, Perrier, and let's say I don't like Perrier in that same bottle, would I know right away that something was wrong? I might, and I actually might not, because all of the other cues are so strong that I'm drinking a Pellegrino that my mind might actually be fooled. My taste receptors might actually be fooled, because it's impossible to taste something in pure isolation, as you pointed out. Every single thing is going to be affecting it. It's also going to matter how I feel. So let's go back to that glass of wine. If I'm in a really foul mood, I'm probably not going to like the same bottle that I would have liked if that day I had been incredibly productive and now I'm having a dinner to celebrate. That emotional background, which has nothing even to do with the wine, will also influence me. So these expectations come from two different places. They come from things that are intrinsic to the product, whether it's Pellegrino or wine or whatever else, an automobile, or something that's completely external, that is just the background, how you're feeling, what you just did, what you're thinking about, but that still influences things as basic as human taste.
Yeah, and what's interesting about this, I mean, you've essentially said this, but it's worth driving home the point, that if you take some kind of junky wine and throw it into a bottle that will please me in some way because of its label or because of some kind of poignant association I have towards it or because I've been told by Robert Parker or somebody that it's really good, and then I drink it, I taste it, and I say it's really good, if I'm in a cranial MRI, in fact, I'm not just being a jerk claiming this. My actual pleasure sensors, the receptors that show up in the brain as raw sensors of pleasure, are lighting up in a way that is completely fooling me.
Absolutely. It's crazy to think about at what deep a level we end up being fooled. We really do experience more pleasure if we have the exact same wine poured out of two different bottles and we're told that one costs, let's say, $10 and the other costs $50. We're really going to enjoy that $50 wine. We're not going to enjoy that $10 wine nearly as much. Our brains will light up in completely different patterns. Our taste palates will experience completely different things, and yet we'll be drinking the exact same bottle of wine. It gets even funnier than that, though, because you can often fool people into thinking they're drinking a red wine when they're really drinking a white wine if you just add odorless and tasteless food coloring.
And some of these people that you can fool are people who are actually nominally know something about wine, or at least they would claim to, right?
Absolutely. But, you know, what wine experts will tell you is, well, of course, even experts can get fooled by this, because normally something like the color of a wine tells you something. So even before you're going to taste it, you're going to look at the color. You're going to put it to the light, because that consistency, that color, the exact shade of red, is going to tell you a lot about the qualities of the wine that you'll be experiencing. And it's really difficult when those end up lying and those go against all of your prior experience. And where a wine expert would actually differ from us is those things that might affect me, like the label, the price, etc., those types of things probably won't affect the true expert as much. But things like color, things like smell, things like what I know about the region where that wine comes from, all of that is still going to affect the taste of the wine.
All right. You know who would not be fooled by this? Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes would not be deceived by things like labels and quaint emotional associations that one has. Maria Konnikova, it's been so great to talk to you. Big admirer of your work. We look forward to hearing you also on The Gist with Mike Pesca, where you do Does This Have the Ring of Veracity? Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. We'll be back. We'll take a break. We'll be back with Amanda Hess, who's close to breaking a record, I think, for appearing on The Scramble, or whatever. This is not The Gist, right? This is The Scramble. I can't keep things straight anymore. All right. Welcome back to The Scramble. Today on The Scramble, we've just talked to Maria Konnikova. Now we're talking to Amanda Hess, and then we'll be talking to Juliet Masur. So do we have, like, the happeningest writers in journalism right now? I think we kind of do. This is quite a trio. So Amanda Hess is joining us right now. She's a regular writer for Slate. You may also see her blog at sexwithamandahess.com. Today she's educating us about a concept so new to me that I'm not even sure I know how to pronounce it correctly, but I think it's ironic misandry. Is that how you say it? Do you say misandry, Amanda?
That's how many Americans pronounce it. So I'm going to go with that.
When you say that, you suggest that there's a continental way of pronouncing it that's more correct or more suave anyway.
When I've spoken to some English women about the issue, they would say ironic misandry.
Misandry. I kind of like that better, even though the British pronounce all kinds of things in peculiar ways. I think misandry sounds a little bit better. You can say misandry and I'll say misandry, and that'll be one of the many ways in which we are divided by our sexes. Yeah. First of all, just sort of sketch this out for people. This is sort of an exaggerated, slogan-driven way of kind of talking about differences between feminists and anti-feminists, but that doesn't even begin to do justice to it. So I'll let you do justice to it.
Okay, so one thing that we've seen over the past few years is feminists, many of whom sort of live and do their work on the internet, using very exaggerated, man-hating phrases to identify themselves to each other and to sort of jokingly take down their critics. So these are women who are buying mugs that say male tears that they will drink from to suggest that they are not very concerned with the concerns of men. They'll wear a T-shirt that says, I bathe in male tears. Maybe they'll bake a cake that says misandry on it or kill all men. And it's really just this sort of internet-wide joke that's supposed to puncture this idea that all feminists are secretly conspiring to take down men and that they're really this sort of outdated idea of man-hating people.
So it's sort of a homeopathic treatment that treats the symptoms by exacerbating the symptoms. Do you think it works? I mean, reading your piece, I sensed some questioning anyway about whether this is a great idea.
Yeah, I think it works depending on what you want to get out of it. So if you're a feminist on the internet who is sparring with men's rights activists or other anti-feminist critics, you're probably not going to change their mind by saying, I bathe in your tears, or why don't we just kill all men?
Right.
That's probably not going to be a very effective solution in terms of an argumentative tactic. But a lot of feminists on the internet aren't really interested in actually engaging with people who are feminist critics because they see their position as absurd and ridiculous. So one way that it is helpful to some women is that it sort of lightens the mood a little bit. If you're a feminist on the internet who's getting a bunch of abuse from people who are saying that by trying to empower women, you're really just destroying men, it can be a little more pleasant to just make a joke about it instead of trying to interact with people who are never going to come around. And in that way, it's helping feminists find each other also. So it's often used as a way to create an in-group, in-joke identification as opposed to this outward-facing response to critics.
Of course, the trick is to keep it or for it to be inward facing, right? Which almost nothing is in the digital age. I mean, Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre can write back and forth about sex and gender and say anything they want. And until the letters wind up in some archives, nobody will know. But when you do something on the internet now, the chance that it's going to filter back to one of the people you don't want to engage with. I mean, basically, this is a posture that kind of apes the posture of Rush Limbaugh. But, you know, if in fact the whole ironic misandry filters back to Rush Limbaugh, he's going to make hay out of it. It's going to really give him ammo. And do you want that?
Right. And so just by writing a story about this on Slate, I should say that, first of all, I don't really engage in misandric jokes. It's just not really my style. But I did write a story about it for Slate. And just by virtue of writing the story, I've gotten a lot of tweets and emails from people who are saying that I want to exterminate men, or saying, well, can't I just joke about rape now if you can joke about men crying? And it's not an element that I really want to involve myself in. So this is the whole, you know, it goes back to the dilemma about whether we should feed our trolls or whether we should just ignore them.
And I think it also, it goes back to the whole question of what's the appropriate rhetoric for the disenfranchised class. So let's all agree that women are still in significant ways disenfranchised. Men hold more of the power. And it's very common for the disenfranchised class to joke about the class that has more power. So white people, black people have joked about white people in certain ways over the years. Gay people have joked about straight people in certain ways over the years. But you sort of don't want to do that joking in a way that inflames some of the problems. So, you know, typically gay people might joke about straight people, but they're probably not going to walk around with a T-shirt that says ban straight people, or, you know, and maybe they would, actually. I don't know. You know, I mean, black people joke about white people, but if they're walking around with a T-shirt that says I bathe in white people's tears, you know, that's going to seem a little off somehow. So that's really kind of, to me, the interesting question. I get that humor is a way of dealing with these power imbalances, and it's a way of making the disempowered party feel a little bit comforted, I guess, and to take a little comfort in the absurdity of the other side. But I feel as though men leave enough things on the table that can be legitimately ridiculed and made fun of without having to go to kind of the reductio ad absurdum stage that misandry is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is, you hit on one of the more interesting parts of this phenomenon, which is that it does seem to be, on a large scale at least, a feminist tactic and not, for example, an anti-racist tactic. And I think, to a certain extent, that speaks to the power of the feminist movement in that it's, you know, tends to be a little bit more organized you know, has found a way to become newly relevant to younger women, many of whom are furthering this trend. But it also does sort of recommend the men's rights activist argument a little bit, because feminists do have this modicum of power. And so men's rights activists are saying, well, now if women can joke about this, you know what that really means is that they have power, and so what are they complaining about? So it is sort of, it's a dilemma, but I do think, you know, part of the reason that some women are interested in this is because they are not interested in thinking about it as much as you and I may be thinking about it, and that just by, you know, putting out a misandrist joke, that is their way of trying to shut down the conversation, laughing a little bit, and reestablishing the bonds between other women, as opposed to legitimately engaging with these people who despise them for trying to empower women.
What is really is lacking in this debate most of the time is any kind of sense of humor. And we encounter this all the time, that, you know, the complaints that we got from both sides. I think we had a housekeeping expert on one day who was just sort of proceeding. It was Heloise, right? I think it was whoever writes the Heloise column right now was proceeding from the assumption that men are slobs, and men were, there were men who were really offended by that kind of default assumption about them. I had a panelist on a show the other day, who was joking about the fact that now that Thor is a woman in the comic books, the comic book heroes are all going to have book clubs. And a woman was horrifically offended by the notion that women have book clubs, or that superheroes would have book clubs if more superheroes were women. And you sort of think, wow, I mean, the one thing that we probably do need anyway is the ability to laugh a little bit about some of this stuff, as opposed to, I mean, I think we now have become like World Cup soccer players, where we just, you know, fall on the ground and writhe as if grievously injured by every single thing that's said to us.
Yeah, it's a fascinating space to be working in. I can tell you that much. I do think, though, that there's something sort of counterintuitive about ironic misandry, and that's this. So when people say ban all men or kill all men, you would think that that's something that is alienating, like, all men, not just men who are, you know, sort of weenies about feminism. But what I found, and what Jess Zimmerman, who's a writer who I quote in the story, wrote her own piece about how this ironic misandry movement can actually be very open to male involvement. Because if you're just a regular man who doesn't hate feminists, you can really get on board with this, because ironic misandry is taking a shot at these very extreme anti-feminist forces. And most men, while they're usually not full-throated feminist advocates, most men are not anti-feminists. So it does open this space where they can make fun of these other men too, while sort of ingratiating themselves with the movement a little bit.
The ways in which that I need to say that Rush Limbaugh is a jackass could never be fit on a coffee mug. I need so much more space for that, Amanda, but I appreciate the sentiment, and I appreciate the writing that you've done about it. It's always a delight to have you on the show. Amanda Hess, writer for Slate, and you can also read her work at her blog, sexwithamandahess.com. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back with a conversation, a somewhat grimmer conversation, about what happened on a dirt track on Saturday night.
Awfully glad that mother had to marry father, but I hate men. Of all the types I've ever met within our democracy, I hate.
Come on now, my I kill puppies just to watch them die coffee mug is an ironic exaggeration. Don't you people get that? People who don't get irony are worse than puppies. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Josh Nalea and Britt Hill. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Cale Yarborough. For show pages, articles, and photos of the Faith Middleton Show staff wearing Mickey Rourke t-shirts, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, the new movement toward tiny houses. And now, back to Colin.
All right. In writing that, I somehow or other managed to leave off the name of the intern, who actually is here working the phones. That's Allison Ehrenreich. She's here with us today. All right. So we have been wanting to have this particular writer on for a very long time. We were lucky to get her today. Juliet Macher is a columnist for the New York Times. Am I saying your name correctly? I've read your name many times, but that doesn't necessarily know.
It's Macher.
Macher. Okay. Macher. I got it. All right. So over the weekend, obviously, this is a horrific tragedy happened on the race track. This is Saturday night and Canandaigua, the death of Kevin Ward in a type of auto racing. It's possible to be a pretty avid sports fan and not know that much about auto racing. I think I probably fall exactly into that category. It's difficult to know where to start, but this involves a driver named Tony Stewart. We'll talk maybe a little bit about the specifics of him, although I'm kind of interested in some of the larger questions this raises. But the specific Juliet, of Tony Stewart are that he's a very, very well-known driver in auto racing and kind of known for a streak of aggression, correct?
Exactly. I started covering, actually, NASCAR was my first beat out of journalism school in 1997. And back then he was just coming onto the NASCAR circuit, and he has been the resident hothead of NASCAR ever since. I mean, it seems like he's constantly fighting with people. More than several times he's gotten out of his own crash car to seemingly try to fight the driver that has crashed his car into the wall, or throw his helmet at a car or a driver. So Yeah, he's NASCAR's bad boy and has been for a very long time.
So in this race, he bumped this other driver, a very young driver, 20-year-old Kevin Ward. Kevin Ward kind of did the same thing. And once his car had come to a stop against the wall, he got out of the car. And in what, to those of us not familiar with this world, just looks like an insane behavior, walks out onto the track where these cars are, you know, racing by at incredibly high speeds under minimal amounts of control. And he's pointing his finger. He's gesticulating. And eventually one car passes him. And then Tony Stewart's car comes back around the track. And it seems to, well, it does. It sideswipes him. It catches him in the rear wheel. He's run over and then flung 50 feet or so by it and dies. And I mean, obviously, one of the things that everybody wants to debate is whether this was intentional, whether this was part of the aggression, whether he was trying to teach this guy a lesson by maybe scaring him. We're not going to know that probably ever. We're certainly not going to have anything resembling an answer, if there ever is one, I assume, for months and months and months, right?
I'm not sure if we'll ever know exactly what went through either driver's mind at the time. I knew Tony Stewart pretty well at one time, and he didn't seem like the type of person to try to, obviously, to kill somebody. I don't think anybody goes out of their way to do that. Whether he was trying to scare the guy or not, I can't be sure. But unfortunately for everybody involved, there's a video online that's been circulating of the incident. It's from all the way on the other side of the track, so you can't really see exactly what goes on. Some people claim that they hear and see Tony Stewart accelerate, and when you accelerate on a dirt track, your car kind of fishtails as you're going through a curve, and that's when he evidently hit Kevin Ward Jr. So I'm not sure what exactly happened, and I think that it's just a sad incident all the way around, and it happens in NASCAR and at these tracks every once in a while, where people kind of have to check themselves and say, you know, this is a really dangerous sport, and sometimes people get very injured, and sometimes people die.
So I think it also opens up a can of questions about sports in 2014, questions that you've been writing in various forms about over the last few years. I mean, one of the persistent questions about sports today seems to me to be, how far do we want sports to diverge from the way the rest of us live? How dangerous and aggressive and violent do we want sports to be? And also, as we shape athletes into those kinds of players in violent and dangerous sports, you know, how big a surprise is it when they turn out to exhibit some of those tendencies in ways we don't want them to, both on the field and in off the field? I feel like all of those questions are there. You know, we talk a lot about this with football. You know, you could make it safer. You could have fewer concussions. Would it still be the same sport? And it's still there. It's there with auto racing, right? You could create a form of auto racing where, and I think there are leagues like the NHRA where even the mildest appearance of aggression results in immediate disqualification. You could make auto racing less aggressive than it is, but it wouldn't have the same appeal, I assume.
Yeah, I don't think that NASCAR is anywhere as appealing as it once used to be. When I was first covering it, some of the old-timers were still around, like Dale Earnhardt, Bill Elliott, who obviously wasn't that aggressive, but obviously Dale Earnhardt was the intimidator. I don't even know if he ever got into a fist fight with anybody, because everyone was already so afraid that he would just knock them into the wall during a race. But NASCAR from the beginning is all about aggression. It's about knocking your rear bumper against somebody else, knocking them out of the race, making it to the finish, you know, getting out of your car if another guy has crashed your car, and basically, you know, probably beating him up in that time. I mean, one of the most famous NASCAR races ever was the 1979 Daytona 500, which I wrote about in my column today, in which that was the first nationally televised 500-mile race. It was a really big deal for NASCAR, which wasn't very popular back then. And on the last lap, Donnie Allison and Cale Yarborough were going down the track, and they were bumping into each other, and they basically crashed each other and ended up in the infield. And then Bobby Allison, who was Donnie's brother, came along to try to see if the guys were okay. And they got into a huge, huge fist fight. And they start kicking each other. I'm sure they would have bitten each other if they had a chance. They tried to choke each other and punching each other. I mean, it was pretty mortifying if you thought about it. But NASCAR loved it, and the fans loved it. This is their first taste of NASCAR, right? This is the first time they see it on television. And not only are these guys driving crazy miles an hour on the track, but they're beating each other up afterwards. And it's just exhilarating to those of us who don't do that on a daily basis.
Well, and so that's one of the ways that, that people use sports, right? It's a vicarious experience of aggression that we wouldn't feel comfortable exhibiting. Sometimes people say it's a metaphor for war. And I think, you know, within Kevin Ward, this poor young guy who died, he grew up pretty much imbued with everything that you just described, right? And maybe, you know, had sort of a natural tendency to emulate some of the behavior that you just described.
Yeah, that's, I mean, on these small tracks, that probably happens more than people know, more than people who don't really know, follow NASCAR or haven't been to a dirt track race on a Saturday night. I mean, these guys probably know each other, and they probably do this, you know, it's probably not uncommon that they get out of their car and shake their fist at somebody and maybe try to go after somebody afterwards. But, you know, I don't know what was going through his mind, and it's sad to think about it, that, one, he thought it was okay, and two, you know, Tony Stewart has done that many times on the NASCAR circuit, like, you know, getting out of his car and trying to intimidate the other driver who has put him into the wall. So, you know, it's part of the fabric of the sport, and unfortunately sometimes these things happen. I don't know whose fault it was or if anybody was at fault, if it was just an accident, but it's pretty horrific.
One of the things that I also wonder about, I mean, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation if the only thing that existed were some news articles about a guy who died on a dirt track in Canandaigua. Okay, so the fact that it involves Tony Stewart, who's such a big name, that makes it a bigger story. But what really makes it a big story is this highly portable video shot by an amateur that people have seen. People have watched a lot. And we're living in this age of highly portable videos, some of them shot by amateurs, some of them shot by professionals. That, first of all, you have to make a decision about whether you want to watch it. Do you want to watch Kevin Ward die? Do you want to watch basketball player Paul George break his leg in two places in this horrible way? But we're living in this age where we're kind of educated about all this stuff, you know, by these videos that we wouldn't have been able to see probably 20, 30 years ago, Joe Theismann's broken leg notwithstanding. And so you sort of wonder about the significance of those and the ways in which they either increase and whet our appetites for this kind of stuff or make us recoil from this kind of stuff. We probably don't know the answer, but it is sort of a game changer, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think that, frankly, most people in America probably didn't even know who Tony Stewart was yesterday morning when they got up until they got up and read the newspaper and thought, wow, this sounds crazy. This guy, Tony Stewart, sounds crazy, and he killed a person. I mean, they're jumping to these conclusions based on this video that to me, it seemed very grainy, and you can't see the angle in which he actually hits Ward, and you do see Ward laying on the ground afterwards, but people were saying, absolutely, I know that Tony exactly saw Ward and knew what he was doing, that he could see him, that he hit him on purpose. I mean, we don't know. Ward was dressed all in black. It's a pretty dark track. These things they're not lit up like the Daytona 500. Or the racing that they have at night, the Richmond track or anything like that. So I'm not sure what he saw, but it seems like everybody has their opinion on it. And I think that's pretty sad because a family is grieving today and a lot of people kind of lose perspective on the whole thing.
You know, it does also make you think. The fact that we're talking about this now, and as you say, I mean, probably the average American didn't know who Tony Stewart was prior to this, but we're talking about this right now on a radio show that doesn't get necessarily involved in sports. I mean, in terms of it being an argument for shutting down some of the aggression, for making auto racing safer, and we know this could happen. You could shut down aggressive behavior in races pretty easily if, in fact, NASCAR or any of the other governing bodies really wanted to. But the fact that we're having this conversation right now about auto racing, where we wouldn't ordinarily have one, suggests really that this isn't going to be an impetus for making auto racing any safer or less aggressive.
No, because I think that auto racing, there's a fine line, and the racetrack promoters probably know this more than anybody, is there's a fine line between having these drivers and the safest cars ever and having really strict rules about what they can and can't do in the car and also out of the car. Like, don't get out of your car even under a caution because it could be dangerous. And on the other side of the coin is that they like this kind of stuff because fans like it. I'm sure a lot of fans at the racetrack were watching Kevin Ward get out of his car and thinking, oh, is there going to be a fist fight between him and Tony, or what's going to happen? And that's part of the entertainment of the whole sport, which I said before, you know, back when NASCAR was founded in 1948, the guys were probably fighting all the time on the sands of Daytona when they were racing. If one guy knocked, well, back then they were driving the cars that they drove to the race in the race. So if somebody wrecked your car, you were really mad because you probably didn't have a ride back to North Carolina where you had been running moonshine. So back then it was a real problem if you wrecked somebody's car. But I think that auto racing is almost in every sport. I mean, you want people to, or some fans want.
You know, Juliet McCourt, I hate to interrupt you, but we're absolutely flat out of time, as is sometimes the case in sports, too. The shot clock's going off. Juliet McCourt, it's been so great to get you on the show, finally. I'm a big fan of your writing, and I've got to jump out, too, here.
I'm Kyone Wolf. I'm going to work 3 seconds out of every 10 and then nap. Wait a minute, that was a second over. How do I put in for overtime?